Welcome to Let My People Think, the weekly program featuring speeches, lectures, and sermons by Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias. Our program format has been a bit different in recent weeks in order to accommodate a series of programs called the Top 5 Questions. As we continue this series, you will hear from not only Ravi Zacharias, but also from another Christian apologist, Dr. William Lane Craig. Ravi and Dr. Craig had the privilege of participating in a conference held on the campus of the University of Iowa, where they were asked to respond to the top five questions that university students ask about Christianity. When we left off last week, Ravi was in the midst of answering the question, "How can there be a good God when there is evil and suffering in the world?" For many honest skeptics, it is this question more than any other that makes God's existence seem unlikely. Indeed, which of us can look at the suffering in the world or the suffering in our own lives and not want to ask, why? Couldn't God have made a world in which we would never experience evil or pain? We'll begin today with a conclusion to Ravi's answer.
When we talk generally of the best of all possible worlds, philosophers have given us four possibilities. Would it not have been better for God to have created nothing rather than creating this kind of a world, no world at all? Number two, would it not have been better for God to have created a world where there was no such thing as good or evil, an amoral world? Number three, would it not have been better for God to have created a world where people would only choose good, a kind of a robotic world? Why did he create a world like this, where there was the possibility of good and evil? As soon as you use the word better for God to have created the first three, once again you're invoking a moral law and an ability to decide what better would have been. C.S. Lewis points this out constantly. The moment you use the word better, you're assuming a way to measure what would have been morally better or superior. So why then this world? I think in this empirical adequacy slant to the question, I want to make this simple comment. Love is known in our experience to be the greatest of all ethics. Love is the supreme ethic. I don't think it was accidental that when somebody like Teresa was being buried in Calcutta, that Hindus, Muslim, Buddhist people from all over the world, including the atheist president of Albania, stood silently beside her corpse in recognition that a life had been beautifully lived and a life that had loved. It is the supreme ethic. So when they look at her will and look at the fact that nothing to her name, a life spent in love, the world of every perspective recognizes the supremacy of love. Love is only possible where the opposite is possible too, to reject love and to choose something contrary to it. So in the best of all possible worlds, if love is the supreme ethic, this is the world that makes it possible. In the logical case, the question can become self-defeating. In the empirical adequacy, love is made possible. In the experiential relevance, think of it this way now. If I were to take a life, just whimsically, it would obviously be something evil for me to do it, for the simple reason that I cannot restore that life. But if the author of life and the creator of life takes my life, has he really taken it when he also has the power to restore it to the very purpose for which this life was originally created, to enjoy that relationship with him and to glorify him? So take the standard example. Why does a five-year-old suddenly die? How can a God of love and a God of goodness justify that? When that child loses that life, in the Christian frame of reference, that life is not lost to God. That life will spend eternity with God as that child is drawn back to God himself who made that child, made that little one. Now you've got the bereaving father or the bereaved mother, the surviving loved ones. God says he gives them strength, gives them sustenance, gives them peace through all of this struggle and through all of this turmoil. One of the best known hymn writers, Annie Johnston Flint, wrote, "He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. He sendeth more strength when the labors increase. To added affliction, he addeth his mercy. To multiplied trials, his multiplied peace. When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere the day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving has only begun. His love has no limit, his grace has no measure, his power has no boundaries known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again." This was not written by a successful Hollywood film actress. It was written by a woman who was orphaned very early in life, A woman who was crippled with rheumatoid arthritis and spent most of her life in bed, had 8 pillows cushioning her body from head to toe because her body was covered with sores for all those years. A woman who was incontinent, who'd lost control of her internal organs, and a woman for whom cancer was sapping away her life. He giveth more grace when the burdens grow greater. So not only is he able to restore the life that is lost, he's able to sustain the one in weakness and in deprivation. What about the skeptic who looks at the tragedy of that lost life and raises the question? It may be a strong reminder to the skeptic to awaken the moral reality of the nature of this universe, and to help the skeptic understand that the very raising of the question reflects a moral law and a moral lawgiver, so that all involved in witnessing this tragedy have some witness of God in the process of raising the question. The one who loses the life, to have it restored. The one who is bereaved, to have the sustenance. And the one who asks the question, to recognize that the question is only valid if God himself exists. Let me tie it together. Which we are left with it is this: the fact of healing, fear evil, the face of evil, and the feeling of evil. We see this all around us. The fact of evil, the only way to justify it if there is an objective moral order. The face of evil, the accountability, the personal responsibility. God talks about this in his word. And the feeling of evil, the reason we react the way we do is because something within the heart says, this is wrong, or this is painful, or this is grievous. How does it fit into a scheme of coherence and morality? A classic example of this in two contrasting illustrations, very quickly here in a moment or so. I remember doing a lectureship in Hong Kong on this subject, and a man who was a lover of Nietzsche and followed Nietzsche's writings stood up in the middle and said to me, life was meaningless, life had no purpose, he did not think even evil had any valid point of reference, the world was just sort of spinning along, a kind of a Sartrean type of a thrustness, we were in there, empty bubbles floating on the sea of nothingness, no moral judgment was pertinent. After the talk was over and I'd responded to his question, I asked him to see me afterwards. He came to the platform and I was surrounded by a whole lot of people. I said, sir, I want to ask you a question. If I took a 2-year-old child and put that child on this platform and took a sword and cut that child up ruthlessly to bits, would you think I have done something wrong? He paused and he said to me, I would not like it. Would not enjoy it, but I can't really say you would have done something wrong. The people standing around were aghast. I said, my dear friend, even you, while denying the fact of evil and denying the face, the responsibility of evil, find it inescapable to run from the feeling of evil. Even you would not like it. You better find out why you don't, or you will live in a world of complete chaos and complete cruelty. The reality of evil points us to the existence of God and his answer on the cross. Thank you.
There's so many things that one would like to say about this profound question. Let me just add a couple of points. I think that one of the reasons that we tend to find the problem of suffering and evil in the world so intractable is because we just sort of naturally assume that if God exists, then his purpose in life for us must be human happiness in this life, that God's purpose is to make us happy. And the suffering and the gratuitous pain in life don't seem to contribute to that end. But you see, on a Christian world and life view, that assumption is false. The purpose of life is not human happiness as such, but rather the knowledge of God, which in the end will lead to ultimate human fulfillment and happiness. And there are many evils and sufferings in this life which I think are utterly gratuitous with respect to producing human happiness, but which may not be gratuitous with respect to producing a deeper knowledge of God, either on the part of the sufferer or on the part of those around him. And I strongly suspect that it may well be the case that only in a world involving a great deal of gratuitous natural and moral evil that the maximum number of people would come freely to a knowledge of God and his salvation. And I say this not simply by faith, but really on the empirical basis of the demographics of the world today. If you read around the world where the gospel is increasing and multiplying at its most rapid rates, there is almost a one-to-one correlation with countries where intense suffering is occurring and where the growth of the church is moribund and the church is flabby and the growth rates are flat is in the West, where we are so comfortable and so content. But the countries like El Salvador, China, Ethiopia, countries in Africa, where the gospel is growing at amazing rates, it is precisely those countries where intense moral and natural suffering has occurred. So I think that we constantly need to keep in mind that God's purposes in life are much broader than what is merely conducive to our happiness. His ultimate purposes are to establish the kingdom of God. And what we suffer should always be seen in light of that greater overarching purpose. And that leads me to a second comment that I want to make, that our suffering always needs to be seen, I believe, in light of the cross. Because God shows us in the cross that He is not a distant ground of being or an impersonal crater who coolly sits by and watches us suffer. When people ask, when they go through intense suffering, where is God? Then we ought to point them to the cross and say, there is God. God is a God who enters into our world of suffering and takes upon Himself the unimaginable suffering of bearing the penalty of the sins of the whole world. Even though He was completely innocent, if anyone could complain of the problem of innocent suffering, it would have been Jesus of Nazareth. And though He was innocent, He took upon Himself the death penalty of sin that you and I deserved. And therefore, seen in light of the cross, the problem of evil takes on an entirely different perspective. When we see His suffering, we now realize that the problem is not how God can justify Himself to us. The problem is how I, filled with wickedness and sin and morally guilty before God, can be justified before Him. And I believe that when we look at the cross, we can say to ourselves as we go through times of suffering, if God would go to that extent, if His love would carry Him to those depths for me, then surely out of my love for Him, I can bear this burden that He's asked me to bear through this short life that I'm enduring now. And I believe that this can give us the grace and the strength to endure what God calls upon us to endure during this life.
Fourth question, which will be fielded initially by Dr. Craig, is the question of the historicity of the resurrection. How can we know that Jesus Christ's resurrection from the dead is actually an historical fact and not simply a legend or myth or story that was created by His followers in order to advance their own movement?
The resurrection of Jesus is one of those events that most folks would say you just either take by faith or not. You just believe in it or you don't. But it's not something to which rational inquiry and investigation would be relevant. But I spent 2 years in West Germany working under one of the leading scholars on the historicity of the resurrection. And I found that the historical grounds for believing that event are really quite good, indeed remarkably good. I've written 3 books on this subject. I've taught a 30-hour course on this, so obviously in 10 minutes I can only very briefly summarize some of what I found. It seems to me that the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus can basically be grouped under 4 broad headings. Number one, that Jesus of Nazareth, after His crucifixion, was buried by Joseph of Arimathea in His personal tomb. This fact is highly significant because if the burial site of Jesus was known to both Jew and Christian alike, then when the disciples began to proclaim the resurrection of Jesus in Jerusalem, the tomb must have been empty. It would have been impossible to proclaim the resurrection of a dead man in Jerusalem if everyone knew that the body still lay interred in the tomb in the hillside. And therefore, the burial story and its credibility is a very important facet of the evidence for the resurrection. Unfortunately, for skeptical critics who deny the resurrection of Jesus, the burial story is one of the best established facts about Jesus. There are numerous reasons that have led scholars to accept the credibility of the burial account. For example, the burial is mentioned by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 in the old information that he hands on that goes right back to the earliest time after Jesus' crucifixion. It is independently verified in Mark's source material that he used in writing his gospel. So we have dual attestation of this event. The fact that Joseph of Arimathea buried Jesus is highly probable in view of the fact that he is described as a member of the Sanhedrin, the very council that condemned Jesus. Given the resentment in early Christian circles toward the Jewish authorities for their condemnation of Jesus, it is highly unlikely that they would have invented a fictitious character like Joseph of Arimathea as a Sanhedrin member who did what was right by Jesus by giving him an honorable burial. Moreover, there are no other independent burial stories in existence. If the burial story were a legend, you would expect to find traces of competing burial legends. There is none. The only one we know of is the burial by Joseph of Arimathea. And thus John A.T. Robinson, the late New Testament critic at Cambridge University, has summarized it by saying that the burial of Jesus in the tomb is one of the earliest and best established facts about the historical Jesus. Fact number two is that on the Sunday morning following his crucifixion, the tomb of Jesus was found empty by a group of his women followers. This fact is also agreed to by the majority of New Testament scholars today, whether conservative or mainstream or whatever, on the basis of evidence such as the following. First of all, the empty tomb story was probably also part of this early source material that Mark used, and therefore goes right back to close after the events themselves and couldn't be a legendary byproduct that arose decades and decades later. Second, it's also implied by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, where he talks about the burial of Christ and then how Christ was raised. Thirdly, the fact that women discovered the tomb is very plausible in light of the fact that the testimony of women was regarded as worthless in first century Jewish culture. Women couldn't even serve as witnesses in a Jewish court of law because their testimony was regarded as having zero credibility. In light of that fact, any legendary story of the discovery of the empty tomb would have certainly made male disciples to have discovered the empty tomb. The fact that it is women who are the discoverers and chief witnesses to the empty tomb is best explained by the fact that, like it or not, they were the discoverers of the tomb, and the Gospels faithfully record what was for them a very embarrassing and awkward fact. Fourth, the earliest Jewish polemic presupposed the empty tomb. When the disciples began to preach the resurrection of Jesus, what did the Jewish authorities say in response? Did they say these men are drunk with new wine, or his body is still there in the hillside? No, they said the disciples came and stole away his body. Now think about that. The disciples came and stole away his body. The earliest Jewish polemic in response to the Christians itself presupposed that that the body was missing, that the tomb was empty. And thus they involved themselves in a hopeless series of arguments trying to explain away the emptiness of the tomb by the theft hypothesis. And thus we have evidence from the very antagonists of the Christians themselves that the tomb was empty. For these and many other reasons, the majority of critics agree that the tomb of Jesus was in fact found empty. As Jakob Kramer, who is an Austrian specialist in the resurrection, has written, "By far, most scholars hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements about the empty tomb." Fact number three is that on various occasions and under different circumstances, different individuals and groups of people saw appearances of Jesus alive after his death. This fact has been firmly established on the basis of the list of eyewitnesses given by Paul in his first letter to the Corinthians, where Paul is quoting an old tradition or information that had been handed on to him, which probably goes back to within the first 5 years after the crucifixion. And when you look at these appearances, they are remarkable. Jesus appeared not just once, but many times. Not just to one person, but to different persons. Not just to individuals, but to groups of people. Not just at one locale and one set of circumstances, but at various locales and under different circumstances. Not just to believers, but to unbelievers, skeptics, and even enemies. Secondly, these appearance traditions are confirmed in the gospel accounts of the appearance stories, so that again you have multiple attestation of these appearances. And therefore, even the most skeptical critics agree with this point. For example, Gerhard Ludemann, who is a very skeptical, radical critic from Göttingen University in Germany, admits that it is historically certain, this is a direct quotation, it is historically certain that Peter and the other disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. Finally, fact number four is that the earliest disciples came to believe that Jesus was risen from the dead, despite their having every predisposition to the contrary. I mean, think of the situation the disciples faced following the crucifixion. Number one, their leader was dead, and Jews had no belief in a dying, much less rising, Messiah. Secondly, according to Jewish Old Testamental law, anyone who was executed or by crucifixion was thereby shown to be a heretic, a man literally under the curse of God. Thirdly, the Jewish belief had no expectation and hope of anyone's rising from the dead before the resurrection at the end of the world. And yet these earliest disciples indisputably came to believe sincerely that Jesus of Nazareth was risen from the dead, and they were willing to go to their deaths for that belief. C.F.D. Moll, a Cambridge University scholar, has said that we have here a belief which literally nothing in terms of antecedent historical influences can account for apart from the resurrection itself. Now, those four facts are broadly recognized by the majority of New Testament critics today. The only question is, how do you best explain them? And I would simply argue that the hypothesis, God raised Jesus from the dead, is the best explanation of those facts when you compare it to any other explanation that you can think of. Hallucinations, theft hypothesis, swoon theory, whatever. If you compare the historiographical criteria for the best explanation, like explanatory power, explanatory scope, plausibility, not being ad hoc, not contradicting accepted beliefs, and far exceeding its rival theories in meeting those first several conditions, I think you can show convincingly that the hypothesis God raised Jesus from the dead best meets those criteria for being the best explanation. And therefore, I think the rational man can hardly be blamed if he concludes, on the basis of the evidence, that a divine miracle occurred on that first Easter morning.
It's interesting to go even beyond the biblical narrative, because one might say there was a vested interest, although there is so much that Bill has already presented that would rise above that criticism. But I find it utterly fascinating, as one who studied and taught world religions, that to see how those worldviews, particularly religions at that time that were emerging or subsequent to that, that were even antithetical in character to the Christian faith, have responded to this. I think particularly of the Quran, that here is a completely different belief in the Islamic worldview, and yet the Quran identifies two of the cardinal doctrines of the Christian faith. Number one, the virgin birth of Christ, and number two, that Christ had the power to raise the dead. In two different places in the Quran, that power is given to Christ, the very power to raise the dead. That power, I think, obviously showing that he was Lord over life and over death, and then raised again to life by his own Father, as it was predicted and prophesied in the Scriptures.
That was Ravi Zacharias on the campus of the University of Iowa answering the question, how can we know that Jesus' resurrection from the dead actually happened? Ravi will be back next week to finish his answer. Let's review what Dr. Craig had to say about Jesus' resurrection. He suggested that there are four major facts regarding the resurrection that one must consider. That Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea. That the tomb was found empty by women followers of Jesus. That Jesus appeared to many people on different occasions after his death. And that the disciples fully believed in the resurrection even though they had no predisposition to do so. The only explanation for these things, Dr. Craig argued, is that God raised Jesus from the dead. Tune in again next week as we continue this series. Today's broadcast, The Top 5 Questions, is available through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries as part of a 2-tape album. The album features the complete responses of Dr. Zacharias and Dr. William Lane Craig to the top 5 questions asked by university students about Christianity. It also features an open session in which the speakers answer questions from the audience. When ordering, ask for tape number CA210, The Top 5 Questions. That's CA210, The Top 5 Questions. If you listen in the United States, place your credit card order by calling 1-800-448-6766. That's 1-800-448-6766. The order line is available 24 hours a day. When you place your order, ask for your free copy of Ravi's newsletter, Just Thinking. The newsletter contains articles by Ravi and members of his ministry team that can be a helpful tool for understanding the issues of our day. To order online, go to rzim.org. That's rzim.org. There you'll find information about Ravi's ministry, essays and articles, and archived files of the Let My People Think broadcasts. The Online Resource Center is an interactive, user-friendly way to preview and order resources. Once again, that's rzim.org. If you prefer to write, address your envelope to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. That's RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. In Canada, contact our office there at 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. That's RZIM 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. Please be sure to give us the call letters of the station when you contact us. Knowing which station you're listening to can help us better evaluate the effectiveness of the broadcast. This weekly program, Let My People Think, is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.